Merkel Media.
Lashback Fridays here on Macroaggressions, taking you back to September 4th, 2021. Graveyard of Empires with Scott Horton. If you're thinking of converting some of your soon-to-be-worthless Federal Reserve notes into tangible gold and silver, maybe even your IRA and 401k, talk to our sponsor, Tony Arterburn, over at Wise Wolf Gold and Silver. Just go to www.macroaggressions.gold. Now, please enjoy the show.
Merkel Media.
But the reality is that they're simply overmatched. And if it comes down to a real war, China's going to win it. And if you look closely, you'll see that when the Navy does red-blue war games on this, the Chinese win. The American fleet goes to the bottom of the ocean, and the Chinese take Taiwan anyway.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff to German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, Macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I am your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic, Rockfin, Odyssey, sometimes YouTube, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We do appreciate your support. We couldn't do it without the help of our sponsors. Chemical Free Body has been amazing to us. Tim James, the owner of the company, has been on the show several times to explain what he's doing. He's making the best products out there. I feel confident recommending them to my listeners because I'm also a customer of Tim's. I take his products every single day. I feel great. I'll continue to do it. And I think that if you are interested, you maybe should just take a look. Go to chemicalfreebody.com/macro. Read up about it. See if it's right for you on your way out, checking out. Use the promo code MACRO to save yourself some money. And of course, supporting Chemical Free Body helps to support this show. It'll take care of your health as well. Everybody benefits. And also, C60 Purple Power has been amazing to us. Ken Schwartz, the owner and founder, the chief scientist of the company, has been on to explain how it all works. I'm not going to pretend like I understand it. I just know that it does. I take it every morning as well. It is a C60 is a naturally occurring molecule comprised of 60 carbon atoms that forms something that looks like a hollow soccer ball. It is a free radical sponge. It searches your body for free radicals, collects them, and resets itself and does it again and again. It is the most powerful antioxidant known. It is hundreds of times more powerful than anything out there. It has not been approved by the FDA, but luckily the vaccines have, allegedly. So whatever that means to you, I've been taking it for a while. I've had great results. If you're interested, go to c60purplepower.com. Read up about it. See if it's right for you. Promo code MACRO. Use that on your way out. Well, I'll tell you, I love our guest's work. I wish we were talking about unicorns and rainbows. We are not. We are talking about the very serious matter of Afghanistan. Scott Horton is an author. He's written many books, Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. He is the host of the Scott Horton Show and also the editorial director of antiwar.com. Scott, how are you? Good to see
I'm
you
doing
again.
Great, Charlie. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm obviously concerned about what we're facing here in Afghanistan. Obviously, we've had 2 decades of this. It's not like a surprise. We knew we had to leave at some point, but the way in which this was handled, I don't know if there's a good way to get out of to end a war and get out of there, but I would be willing to bet this is the wrong way to do it. So what's your take on what we've been seeing over the last couple of weeks in Afghanistan?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, the whole war has been a catastrophe. People are acting like this is the first time people have died in the war.
Right.
People have been dying in the war by the hundreds of thousands for 20 years. And the whole thing is a catastrophe. It would have been a miracle if somehow the withdrawal had gone off without a hitch or something like that. This is par for this course. I'm not apologizing for it. I'm saying the rest of the war is as bad as this looks. It's just people haven't been looking at the war this whole time. You know, I saw General McMaster says about the suicide bombing and the death of the 13 U.S. Marines and a sailor there that, yeah, this is what happens when you surrender to terrorism. Really? There were all kinds of truck bomb massacres of innocent civilians. The whole time McMaster was there during the surge under Petraeus, people were dying by the tens of thousands while he was there, supposedly abolishing corruption in Kabul. That was McMaster's job before. Yeah, he really succeeded in that. No wonder he got more stars for, you know, showing up to work. And then, you know, there's a brand new article out, in fact, about the massive new escalation of the air war that he oversaw as national security advisor that he insisted upon in the first 2 years of Trump there that just killed tens of thousands more innocent people. And it's a really great article by Jack Murphy, former special operations officer, about how they're just anybody who touches a radio gets a bomb on the head. You know, all through the Helmand province for years and years and years and years, and with no intelligence about who they are or what they've ever done or anything like this, presumed guilty no matter who they are. And this, you know, which is even worse than it was under Obama, which was absolutely horrible, but they made the rules of engagement even looser than that under McMaster, and they achieved nothing. And then McMaster's, you know, leading the chorus now that the failure is simply in admitting failure and finally calling the chips in and saying, forget about it. You know, the best thing about the current situation is that Trump is the one who insisted on signing this deal and that Biden is the one seeing it through. So despite all the partisan critics on either side slinging mud at each other, the reality is they both are working together to do the right thing here for the first time this whole time and finally calling it quits. Now that I got all that off my chest, the question of how they have handled the withdrawal, the Democrats, since Biden has come into power here, is of course they've absolutely botched it. And I mean, the most obvious thing of it is they kicked the can down the road. The deal said we'll be out by May 1st. Well, that's just right toward the beginning of the Taliban's fighting season over there. Right. When things are thawing out and people get back to the business of war, we're supposed to be gone by then. That's your decent interval, like they said in Vietnam, right? Where we get to get the hell out and then you take the capital city after we're the hell out, right?
Right.
And then the fall Saigon looked bad because it wasn't well coordinated enough and there were too many people trying to scramble to get out on the way out. And that was supposedly what to never repeat. But then, so that was their first mistake. But let's say it was you and me in charge and we had to absolutely get this right. Like look at the catastrophe as such is one, the Taliban got all those weapons that we left for the Afghan National Army. All those trucks, all those rifles, all those howitzers, right? Light arms by the millions. Like, who knows what all they got. See the Taliban walking around in Kabul right now with brand new M4s and American night vision and all this stuff, right? So that's one part of it. And then the second part is the, you know, lousily timed and planned evacuation and having to rely on the Kabul airport that only has one airstrip and is right there in town and vulnerable to things like what happened yesterday with the ISIS presumably ISIS suicide bombing. It's definitely not the Taliban who did that, but the suicide bombing that killed all the soldiers yesterday. So now what could we have done to avoid that? First of all, we just stuck with the deadline, maybe even moved it up, right? Like, you're president, you, and I'm your national security advisor. The deal is, here's what we got to do. We got to tell the whole truth to the American people on January 21st and say, listen, the Afghan National Army is a joke, right? You might as well ask the staff of Chuck E. Cheese to protect security in the nation of Afghanistan. It's just not going to happen. Mr. President, go out there, tell them, we just don't believe that this thing can exist. Therefore, we're taking all their weapons away and we're destroying them all or taking them with us. And you throw all the tomatoes you want, and the Republicans can cry all they want and blame us for undermining the Afghan National Army. But we believe it was going to fall anyway. The Taliban would have ended up with those weapons the way ISIS ended up taking all the weapons we left in Western Iraq back in 2014. We don't want to see that. So we're getting rid of the weapons. And you can criticize us all you want for that decision, but we think it's far more likely than not that the Taliban would just end up with them anyway. And as far as the government in Kabul, sorry, we're pulling out all of our civilians, all our spies, all our diplomats, all our mercenaries, all of our staff, all of our everybody, and we're calling it quits on the Kabul government because it's nothing but a joke. You might as well ask, you know, a couple of bums from under the overpass to run the nation state of Afghanistan. It's not going to happen. And you can throw all the tomatoes you want and you can criticize us all you want. And you can say that that is what is undermining the capacity of the Kabul government to stand. But we say, nope, sorry. We predict it was all going to fall anyway. And we want to just go ahead and make sure we got all our civilians out. And then it's, you know, Marines are the last ones to turn out the light as we leave, not civilians desperately running for their lives and right. This kind of thing. But you understand as the way I frame that, and believe me, I'm no partisan man. I'm a Biden accuser my whole life long and his whole career long. But I'm just saying that was the situation they were in. And you see the problem there is they would have been massively blamed for the collapse of the Afghan army and government, for undermining them by pulling all the civilians out and pulling all their weapons away. But they would have had to just take that criticism in order to make sure those weapons didn't get in the Taliban's hands and make sure that those civilians were all out safe. So instead, what they do, instead of sticking with the deadline and telling the whole damned truth, they tried to fudge and they kicked the can down the road and they said, no, no, we built a 300,000 man army and we built a totally credible, sustainable democracy.
Right.
And the army will protect that democracy. And hey, if it can't, well, that's just tough. And that was the real point, right? Was Biden agreed with Trump and with you and me that we can't stay here forever. And this is the end of forever right now, dude. We're leaving. And if they can't stand, so that was like their spin was, hey, we built them a 300,000 man army. They ought to be able to stand. But they, not even the Taliban realized how easy it was going to be to just walk right in and take over the whole country. And they just took military base after military base without even a fight. And then they started moving on the provincial capitals. And then they just took the whole South. And then they were very smart and they headed the Northern Alliance off at the pass and seized all the territory up in the north from bases near Kunduz. And they seized the provincial capital of Kunduz and then Mazar-e-Sharif. And then that was it. I mean, they basically had Kabul completely surrounded and the Hazaras and Ghazni completely surrounded. And then that was it. They just walked. And I've been predicting this for years, by the way, at least the strong possibility that when it came down to it, they would simply walk right into Kabul. And that wouldn't even be a siege or a fight at all. And they would just come right in and push the puppet government that we had propped up over with a finger once we were no longer there to prop it up. And I predicted that exactly that in my book that was published 4 years ago, Fool's Errand.
Damn. Well, so why did the Biden administration push this out several months?
I don't know.
I'm guessing it's politics, right?
Yeah, I think so that was it, right? Part one is, he didn't want to be carrying out Trump's deal. Instead, it would be his withdrawal instead of making him some kind of junior partner to Trump's plan.
Right.
Right. For just ego purposes or that kind of thing. But more importantly, I'm guessing it was the military demanding that we slow walk this thing. You've got to give us a chance to talk us out of this, Mr. President, kind of thing. So the compromise position was, okay, I'll give you a little longer. You know, the Pentagon, they knew. They had a year and a half to get ready to get out of there. They knew the deal was signed on leap day 2020, February 29th, 2020. Said we'll be out by May 2021. So you got a year and 4 months to be ready, you know, to be out on time. But they thought, well, once we get rid of Trump and once Biden comes in, we'll roll him the way we did Obama and Trump before him. And I think Biden's just too damn old and doesn't give a damn anymore. And it's just like, nah, you're not going to roll me on this one. And you can tell it is kind of personal with him too. He's had to give the same speech like 4 times. I'm not changing my mind. Go to hell. Sorry, but I'm not changing my mind. We're leaving. I said so, and I meant it, and that's it. Which is, I got to say, heroic. This is the best thing he's ever done in his life. It's the greatest moment of Joe Biden's entire life and entire career, where he's actually been horrible on just about everything.
Well, so we have 5 decades ago, we have the leaving Vietnam, the symbolic, you know, Chinook helicopter, you know, the helicopters off of the buildings and all of this. We have war colleges. We have very smart people that are very strategic, that understand how this works. How can this happen a second time? How can it happen second time in a row? What is going on? Who is in charge here? And why are they making these mistakes? Because look, I have no background in this at all. And even I know.
It's a government program, man. You know how it goes. And they've been lying this whole time to justify spending money and not having to get a real job. Yeah. And so they built all these fictions. You know, we just went over the most important ones. We built a new government and a new army to sustain it. And it's a democracy and the people of Afghanistan want it. And that's why we did them the favor of building it for them. Well, there's something to give your life for. Many Americans were led to believe.
Yeah.
And, you know, they keep citing 66,000 members of the Afghan army have been killed in this thing. Well, I mean, and it's usually cited as, to prove their devotion to this important cause and that kind of thing. But also, you know, could be looked at the other way, that their lives are just thrown away, these guys. You know, most of them are not special operations guys or anything like that. They're local, you know, fighters in flip-flops who joined simply for a pair of boots and a rifle and a couple of hot meals and, you know, maybe a little bit of money to take home. But their retention rate is less than zero, right? It's just, you know, these guys are essentially cannon fodder if they don't get a chance to go AWOL before they're sent out to the slaughter. And then what are they doing? They're fighting for the North Americans against the South Afghans. Well, what the hell is that? Would you fight? What state are you from?
I'm in Denver, Colorado.
Yeah. So you're going to fight against the mountain people of Colorado at the behest of a foreign government?
No.
Because you're from the front range? You know what I mean?
No.
That's not how this works. Why would that work there? Why would it? Now, they could find some people from eastern Colorado to fight if they were desperate and poor enough for a paycheck. But could they pay them enough to ever win against the mountain people of Colorado hanging onto those mountains? Come on.
No,
they couldn't. And now guess what? Afghanistan is shaped like Colorado. And it's the size of Texas. And also has deserts like California. And this is all just bad lands. And it's a warrior culture where people like fighting. And they have the high ground like Obi-Wan Kenobi. Like, what are you going to do? It doesn't work. It never worked for anybody. So you can occupy the capital city, but you can't win rulership over especially the Pashtun tribes. They just won't give in. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, this was weird to me always from the beginning that they were spreading democracy, you know, air quotes, but to a group of people that have never wanted democracy. They're not interested in that. They have their own way of doing things. It always seemed a bit backwards to me, like that they were trying to force democracy on these people, and these people clearly didn't want it. And it's not as if we didn't know that, because we were involved with financing them to fight against the Soviets back in the 80s. We knew how they were. We knew how they operated. We had to work with that in order to help them defeat the Soviets. In what universe do we think, oh, well, it'll all be different now that we're on the other side of things? Why did we think that?
Well, it depends on who, right? I think a lot of people knew better all along. The people who think that are the useful idiots who kind of go along with the program. But so in December of 2009, the Washington Post published the Afghan Papers, which is a takeoff on the Pentagon Papers from Vietnam.
Right.
And what it was previously classified secret interviews with many of the principal, I think 400 people involved in all aspects of the Afghan war, including some of the major perpetrators of it and participants in it. And some of them just give like answers like they know that they're on candid camera and they're never going to tell the whole truth here. But some of them are like, oh, it's all secret and private and it's just for the inspector general to know, but he's never going to tell anybody, huh? Okay, well, I'll tell you what was really going on over there, Inspector General. And then they spill their guts and they go, man, I'll tell you one story. There was this one guy and then this firefight and then whatever it is. And they just all start spilling their guts. And what they all say in there is that they knew the war could never work. They knew the whole thing was a complete ridiculous catastrophe. Essentially, no more plausible than the Afghan Taliban coming to Colorado and remaking Colorado for you guys.
Right.
It's just, how could you even try to sell that? And then they go, well, yeah, you know. And then the answer is it's all different incentives. Mostly it's their own ticket punching, right? You got to get your little badge that says you've been to Afghanistan and back, especially for officers. You know, they have that incentive to keep the whole war going. Never admit that they lost anything. Never admit that they promised what they can't deliver, you know, which is not really a military victory, but a political victory that they can't even get the military position of strength to negotiate from to even win anything at all. And they knew it all along. And, you know, Douglas Lute, the war czar, says, you know, we didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were doing over there.
Great. Yeah,
how do you like that? How do you like that? In other words, seriously, like no BS and for real, the regular readers of antiwar.com knew a hell of a lot more about what was going on, who was fighting who was on whose side, why this or that thing went the way it did, then the generals in charge of the war. You know, one of these, it was Lute. It was Lute just the other day, a week or so ago. Bill Roggio, who's a hawk, but is a detail-oriented guy, on Twitter, he was castigating Lute because Lute went on, I'm going to say PBS NewsHour. I'm not certain of that, but something like that. And Lute said, well, you know, some of these cities have fallen. So this is a few weeks ago for the fall of Kabul and all that. 2 weeks ago, maybe 2.5 weeks ago. Well, we've had these few cities have fallen here, there, and the other place. And he names them. And he says, but these are all predominantly Pashtun cities. So maybe it's no surprise that the Taliban were able to take them over. And then Bill Roggio says, look, man, here's the statistics. And 3 or 4 of these cities are plurality or even majority, Tajik, Hazara, and Uzbek cities that are not predominantly Pashtun cities, which is important in the context because Lute is saying, well, you know, they're not that strong outside of their home base. Mm-hmm. When the reality is, man, they are gaining strength way outside of their home base, which is an entirely different narrative. And Roggio's point being, that Douglas Lute still doesn't have the foggiest notion of who's who and where's where. The war czar should have the first clue of which of these cities lie on which side of these sort of penciled in ethnic boundaries as they exist in Afghanistan. It's all, you can look it up on the internet and see the ethnic maps and see, you know, where the different, you know, allied warlords are strongest and not and whatever, and just learn it. You wouldn't need classified information for that. You just need the imagination to think you need to know. Here's the guy who is Bush. When Bush got tired of running the war, he goes, oh, I'll hire you to be my war czar. And then Obama kept him. And then he recommended against it, but then he helped implement the massive failed surge anyway, instead of resigning in protest over it. And here it is in 2021. He still doesn't know his ass from a hole in the ground. He doesn't know anything.
So the guy that says we didn't know, you know, we hadn't the foggiest idea of what we're doing. Well, then why are we spending $2.313 trillion?
Stop right there.
On an investment.
Wait, no, you just said it. That's the answer. We're spending $2.3 trillion.
That's the point, is to spend the money.
Of course. The whole thing's a racket.
Yeah.
The whole thing's a racket. They don't care about you, man. They never did.
Never.
No. This isn't about keeping you safe. It never was.
I think I remember there was a guy that wrote a book about something or other being a racket, who might have known a thing or two. According to the Watson Institute at Brown University, and we can take this for what it is. I can't confirm these numbers, but these are
the
numbers.
Do good work. They do. They show their work too. I think they can look into their studies. And
okay, this is what they came out with, and I read today. According to them, 241,000 deaths directly from the war. That does not include disease, water-related, or lack of water, lack of food, or other. You've got 2,442 dead U.S. military, 3,846 dead U.S. contractors, the 66,000 dead Afghani military and police, that number that you mentioned earlier, 47,245 dead civilians. That number seems low to me, but I don't know.
Yeah, definitely.
72 journalists, 444 humanitarian aid workers, and $2.313 trillion, not including interest or long-term care, which we know will add at least another trillion to that. It works out in the current form, it works out to $15,000 per U.S. taxpayer. What'd we get for our money?
Man, I'll tell you, and I guarantee you those are extremely conservative numbers on the casualties on the Afghan side there. Most people killed in Afghanistan, there's no reporter to ever report it. They're way out there in the countryside. No electricity, no nothing, you know? So, so many of those are never told, and complete surveys are essentially impossible in that country. So those are all at least, everything you said there is at least in terms of the cost for those poor people over there. You know, what do we get out of it? I mean, I don't mean this sarcastically or cynically. I mean, what can I say? I think the only real answer is increased trauma care, you know, technologies for people who are severely wounded to save their lives, like in car crashes and that kind of thing, and prosthetic limbs based on the need created by all the American GIs, men and women, who got their arms and legs and other vital body parts blown off. And, you know, their faces need to be reconstructed and all these kinds of things. And then, so that's it, man. I'm sorry. I don't know what else. Unless you cash dividend checks from your ownership of Lockheed stock.
Yeah.
In other words, yes, just U.S. taxpayer money, welfare for rich people. Unless you're in on that game, then this wasn't for you. You didn't benefit anything. You know, you probably lost your little cousin over it or some, you know. It's some horrible thing. And seriously, you know, 2,400 doesn't sound like that much. And I've heard people say a lot of times that, like, oh yeah, we lost that many in 15 minutes at Normandy and all that. Yeah, well, maybe Normandy should have been planned better. You know, maybe you should have got those airstrikes in on those pillboxes and made sure that you hit your targets first or something like that. I don't know.
And not, but anyway, just drop your paratroopers in the wrong spot.
Yeah, seriously. But listen, you know, 2,400 is a hell of a lot of people if you're an individualist, and it's a hell of a lot of people if one of those people is your son or your daughter, you know. Yeah. There's this one that bothers the hell out of me, where these three Marines got shot in the back by the teenage sex slave of the police chief that they were installing in power in this district in Helmand province, or is in Kandahar province, pardon me. And they're working out in the gym. And this young boy, and by teenage, I think he was like 13 or 14, you know, young boy, came in with an AK and shot him all in the back and killed him. And so, you know, think about, you lose your son in a war. Now you find out that he was shot in the back by who? By a boy who was a slave of a cop? That your son was making the police chief of this province in Helmand? What the hell kind of betrayal is that? To send some guy's son who thought he's going to go fight the Wehrmacht out in the fields of France somewhere? Is that it? He's going to be fighting state enemy military combatants? And this is the war that you send him to? You know, it ain't, it, you know, I don't know, man. I, to be perfectly honest with you, I know quite a few veterans of the wars, like through my work. But like in my personal life, I don't think I know anyone whose son died in it that I can think of. I'm sorry, God, if I'm forgetting somebody that I should be thinking of. I'm very sorry right now. I got what Biden's got, forgive me. But, you know, any of us can imagine that, right? Your auntie dies of natural causes of old age and it's the worst thing that ever happened to you. Well, how about if some asshole shot her with a Hellfire missile and exploded her to death? How might you feel about that?
Yeah.
You know, or if your son got blown up by weapons that the Democrats and Republicans gave the Mujahideen back in the 80s that end up, or that Bill Clinton gave to the Taliban in the 90s that end up being used against your son when we turn on them in the 2000s, you know,
yeah.
When, you know, and these are all young men who are supposed to be starting their lives, finishing their education, starting jobs, founding their own businesses, raising their own families. And they're over where? On the Afghanistan, like whoever even should have ever heard of Afghanistan in this country, if it wasn't for our government's intervention there,
yeah,
we wouldn't even know where that is at all if it wasn't for our government's intervention there, you know? And it's just, it ain't fair. It totally sucks for these people, what they've been through, all of them as individuals, you know, families surviving this. I feel terrible for them. And they must feel terrible right now. If they didn't already figure it out, they're figuring it out now. That like, man, you can't believe in these people. They raise you in government school to say, hey, it's a democracy. And the democracy means that the best man wins. Because of course, it's the best people choosing him. And then the best man wins and then he does his best. And you got to trust him because what are you going to do? But what a bunch of crap. When these aren't the best of anybody at all, you know? And look at what they still say about how we still know this, we got to escalate now. We can't call it quits now. When they don't have a coherent thing to say about how we're supposed to ever win that war and somehow convince the Taliban and the Pashtun population in that country to obey us and come into the government we created on our terms. I mean, man, that ship has sailed a hell of a long time ago. David Petraeus promised that impossible result would be accomplished by July 2011. Don't worry. By July 2011, the Taliban will be eaten out of my hand with a bloody nose, doing whatever I say. And then guess what? That was 10 years ago and a month. And it never happened.
Well, what's worse, getting shot in the back by some police, Afghani police chief's sex slave, or dying like 72 soldiers did in one of the Kellogg Brown and Root installed shower systems in Iraq and Afghanistan? This is a horrible choice. So I'm curious though. So what are the implications?
Yeah, was it that many who were like electrocuted to death and stuff?
Yeah.
What was the number you said again?
72.
Jesus Christ. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that it was that many. I knew had happened.
Listen, the Treblinka, it was like, we like what you've done with the showers, you know, your shower system. I mean, it's crazy. And to bring that up, I put that in my first book. Yeah. And to bring that up just sort of highlights the collateral damages of war. It's very easy to go on your nightly news and say, well, we have to do something and we have to act now and we have to go after these bad guys. But then there's so much more to it than that. And the, you know, the repercussions of that, you know, that you bring people come over and get killed and driving down the street there. So you just create these impossible situations for these guys. You put them in there and then you ask them to be brave, and they don't know who the enemy is. The enemy's not wearing a uniform. They don't know who to shoot. They just want to go back home and see their mother. You know, I mean, how dare we do this to these guys? It's just so unfair and it makes me sick. But I'm curious what you think about the implications for the region in general. Like, now there is clearly, there's a power vacuum that may be filled by the Taliban or whoever. But what do you think this means for the region? You've got Iran neighboring it. We know that everyone knows that the U.S. has a hard-on for starting a war against Iran. So is that off the table now that our staging facilities to the east in Afghanistan are no longer an option, or what? How does that change things?
Well, that's a shame. No, I mean, I don't think our bases in Afghanistan would ever been much use against Iran anyway. That would have all been waged from the Gulf and from at sea. You know, a major air war there would have been fought from the Arabian Sea. But no, if anything, this means that we're going to ally with the Ayatollah now to back the Hazaras against the Taliban. Or maybe we're going to switch sides and back the Taliban against the Iranian-backed Shiite Hazaras, who we've been fighting for this whole time. And that's the whole thing about it, man. You know, I have a quote in Fool's Errand from Zbigniew Brzezinski, who helped get us into this mess back under Jimmy Carter back in 79. This was kind of his whole brainchild of a project to back the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. But in his book from 1997, The Grand Chessboard, he says, listen, we got to back the Chinese, Pakistani, Taliban axis in Afghanistan in order to keep the Iranians, the Russians, and the Indians out. Right?
Okay.
Then, so 4 years later, we invade the country, and what do? We take the side of the people who are backed by the Iranians, the Russians, and Indians against the Afghan Taliban and their Pakistani patrons, who are then another link removed, you know, supported by China. So, well, what difference does it make then, right? The right. point is, apparently it doesn't make a difference as long as it's an excuse for intervention.
Right.
Here we've been backing Iran and Russia and India's friends this whole time. And so, you know, try and figure out who you hate most. And my favorite part of this story is really takes place in Syria, where, see if you can keep up with me now, and, okay. and it won't be because I'm too confusing. It's just the situation that is, although I also might screw it up. But in the war in Syria, you had the Americans backing the guys who had been Al-Qaeda in Iraq during Iraq War II, the foreign fighter, suicide bomber, jihadi terrorist. Mm-hmm. 4,000 out of the 4,500 guys, Americans that died in Iraq War II, died fighting against the Sunni-based insurgency, the worst leading edge of which was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, right? The bin Ladenites. Mm-hmm. Well, in Syria, starting in 2011, and especially getting going in 12, they're outright backing Al-Qaeda in Iraq in Syria. Then the Shiite militias in Iraq that America fought Iraq War II for, that pushed the Sunnis into Al-Qaeda's arms back in Iraq War II. Well, they started coming across the border into Syria to take the Syrian government's side, as well as Hezbollah and Iran came. And they all came to save the Syrian state from the American and Al-Qaeda forces that were backed by Turkey and Saudi and Israel and Jordan and Qatar, etc., right? So then when ISIS blows up way too big and rolls back into Iraq and into Western Iraq in 2014, the Iraqi Shiite militias, they got to go home to help protect Baghdad. So they leave Syria and they go home to fight ISIS. So then what's Iran do? Iran goes and gets the Shiite Hazaras from Afghanistan, who are on our side, who we've been on their side backing in power in the coalition in Kabul for the last 15 years at that point, and goes and recruits them and brings them to come and fight on Assad and Hezbollah and Iran's side to protect the Syrian state from America and Al-Qaeda and the other Sunni insurgent forces and allies there. And then the Afghan Taliban, who were fighting in Afghanistan, decide, you know what, there's too much heat here. And some of them, they go to Syria to fight on the CIA and Al-Qaeda and the Sunni jihadist terrorist side in the war in Syria. And so, and the whole thing just keeps going on. And so if you look at it like this, like you have the Sunni axis led by the jihadists when it comes to battle, led by the bin Ladenites, all that is the Saudi side. Mm-hmm. And the other side is the Iranian side in the, you know, Sunni Shia regional war there that really W. Bush kicked off in 2003. And we're the ones who are inconsistent, right? The Saudis and the Iranians, they continue to consistently back their interests, right? So when America was fighting for Iran's side in Iraq War II, the Saudis were financing the Sunni jihadist resistance against us. Well, the bin Ladenite led, but just also the Sunni insurgency against our guys all through Iraq War II. We're the ones who keep changing sides back and forth, not them.
Oh my God. This is so, you're right. I couldn't keep up with it because it's too
confusing. Rewind that twice and you'll be with me, man. I swear. Man,
this is really, it's frustrating. You know, I never served in the military. I wouldn't pretend to know what those guys go through. I would imagine that, that once they get into a battlefield situation, that they're really just trying to make sure that they keep their buddies alive and
that's right.
Get everybody to go home so that they can see their families. I don't know that the politics of it necessarily plays into it, but what a bunch of reprehensible scumbags our government is to keep doing this and keep insisting that we send not just our people to go die, but we're killing the other side and destabilizing this whole region. And for what? What is the point of this all? Is it to destabilize the region so that we can protect our allies like Israel and Saudi Arabia so that they don't get attacked by these other people? Is it money? Is it, this is just busy work for our soldiers in order to justify a $1 trillion budget? Like, I'm trying to make sense of this. And
yeah, it's
and
all those really, things.
I can't.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? It's all a giant conspiracy of interests, especially when it comes to keeping it all going, right? Yeah. Like, why do we really go to Iraq? And that was primarily for Israel. And, you know, Philip Zelikow, who was Condoleezza Rice's right-hand man when she was Secretary of State there for a few years. I have a great quote from him in my book, Enough Already. He goes, look, we don't really talk about this that much because it's not a very good sales job to tell people to get Americans to buy this. But a major undercurrent of what's going on here was Saddam Hussein would pay the families of anybody who died or was killed fighting against Israel or in conflict with Israel in the Palestinian territories. Well, this included the families of suicide bombers, which is, you know, obviously an incentive for people to go ahead, if they're that desperate, be a suicide bomber. At least Saddam Hussein will cut his mom a check or something like that.
Right.
So the idea was, this is a major reason why we got to do this. But they didn't tell the people of Lubbock, Texas, that that's why their son needed to go join up this thing, was to protect Israel from a guy blowing up a bus in Tel Aviv. The story was, they might nuke Amarillo, man, if we don't stop them now, you know, or nuke Lubbock or nuke Austin. Nuke you and your jammies in the middle of the night, as Gordon Prather used to say, if we don't go in there and get them. But that was really the deal. And I show in my book Enough Already that, to the best of my ability, I show the influence of the Israel lobby and led by the neoconservative movement in pushing us into Iraq War II. But yeah, then once it's on, and this is the same thing as in Vietnam, you have every single little division and department of the State Department that has some money to spend and something to prove to show that they deserve to exist for whatever their little parochial reason inside the bureaucracy. And then same thing with all of the military and all of that money. I mean, we're talking $7 trillion spent and must be much more than that in the last 20 years on the terror wars. And that is just, you know, Kelly Vallejos wrote this great thing for the American Conservative magazine back about 3 or 4 years ago, about how they were bulldozing perfectly nice upper middle class suburban neighborhoods in Virginia and just raising them to the ground to build mansions there instead. Right? Like, this is not condemned old slums. This is not even slums. Like, this is not even gentrifying the poor side of town. This is gentrifying the rich side of town.
Right.
Because everybody's that much richer because they're just cashing government checks. And they reformed the landscape of Northern Virginia in all of these, you know, Crystal City and Tyson's Corner and whatever these places where all these contractors live. And it's essentially the entire military industrial complex that they built up from the Cold War. Well, they basically doubled that on the, you know, Homeland Security complex and the rest of the, you know, evolution of the national security state in the last 20 years. It's just, you know, as William S. Lynn said, it's the biggest honeypot in the history of the world, that Pentagon budget. And so, you know, Nick Turse called it the complex. Forget military industrial complex. It's the military everything complex, right? All of academia and science and research and high tech and the media. I got Ray McGovern on my shoulder. The media, who just, you know, are such an important and integral part of pushing all of this stuff. But right down to like toothpaste, right? Like Colgate and Crest, they have to fight like mad over who gets that Pentagon contract to supply for the soldiers there. I mean, that's worth, you're going to give up that field to your competition in whatever business you're in? It just doesn't make sense. If you can sell to the captive market, that is the Pentagon. So it just creates this massive distortion in government power and in the economy. And just think of all the money the banks make just servicing the transaction. The Pentagon pays Boeing. Boeing puts that money in an account somewhere, right? In many different accounts, in many places. And you have an entire other industry there, which, you know, when it comes to what it costs to finance the think tanks and the law firms and all the lobbying firms and everything that continue to push all this stuff forward, it's not even pennies on the dollar, right? It's fractions of pennies on the dollar. You know, there was a big scandal the other year, 4 or 5 years ago now. Lockheed spent $14 million lobbying. I think this is in 2014 or 2015, something. $14 million? Are you kidding me? They spent that on lunch.
That's
they probably spent more than that on lunch. Right? Huh?
I mean, if you could spend $14 million in lobbying in order to get billions of dollars in contracts, you would have to be insane not to do that. They're obviously going to continue to do that.
Right. But think about how many of these like weirdo egghead think tank types that they can pay a yearly salary to churn out these studies to justify their policies for that pittance, right? You can pay somebody a couple of $100,000 a year and they'll churn out study after study after study about why we got to stay. It just costs nothing. You look at all the most important think tanks and institutions who comment on foreign policy or are involved in foreign policy, they're virtually all financed by Northrop Grumman and Lockheed and Raytheon and Boeing. And they don't even hide it. Why would they even hide it? You know, the biggest arms manufacturer, you'd think they just have their subsidiaries donate or whatever, make it seem a little more deniable. And it's right there, Lockheed Martin, $500,000, you know, whatever it is. And that's enough to pay a fellow to turn in studies all year long about why we got to kill people and do it with Lockheed products.
Yeah.
I'm stealing this from my friend Adam. It's the flea wagging the dog. You know, it's not even the tail wagging the dog. It's the flea wagging the dog. It's these tiny little narrow special interests, as Ross Perot would call them, operating at the expense of the rest of us. Right. And that's where it goes right up and crashes right up against your civic religion. We're like, wait a minute. All these white marble monuments and that red, white and blue flag and all these people standing in these hallowed halls of Congress doing these things. There's a national interest involved in there somewhere. Right. But no, that's just your mistaken assumption. That's not how it works. It's just an imperial court and it's every man for himself and everybody get as much as you can. And I mean, they scheme together to get even more for themselves. But look at how completely perverted their idea of what's good for the American people is compared to what you know is right. And it's always, you can just tell how twisted it is that, like, especially look at Afghanistan. No, we have to stay in Afghanistan because of what reasons? Because can they even come up with? Because September 11th was launched from there or something? No, it wasn't. It was launched from Boston Logan Airport. You know what I mean? These guys had to have access to our country. Afghanistan is no special, you know, easy access point to the United States of America. You know, Lindsey Graham one time says, I'm sick of this blowback theory. The idea that we didn't have troops in Afghanistan before September 11th. It's like, yeah, but nobody ever said that. The argument was we had troops in Saudi Arabia and we were attacked by Saudis and Egyptians hiding out in Afghanistan. We weren't attacked by Afghanistan. This is Lindsey Graham. He thinks we were attacked by Afghanistan or the Taliban even, like the regime of Afghanistan. He confuses the whole nation state did it to us. When it wasn't, it was a band of bandits, a tiny little band of criminals hiding out in their no man's land border region in the mountains on the Pakistani border. That's hardly the same thing, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so look, it's been 20 years of this kind of BS. Just think of just Sean Hannity yelling about how right he is and how wrong everybody else is and about how necessary all this is. The last 20 years, you know, and he just is one person to, you know, pick as like the poster boy. But isn't he, right? Him and Bill O'Reilly and the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, Max Boot and Bill Kristol and all these guys. They have done nothing but shamelessly hawk it up this whole time, especially McMaster, generals McMaster and Petraeus coming out and complaining like they are now. They lost the war. I mean, hell, if you were a civilian in the Pentagon with a bow tie, I guess you could just blame the general. Well, I was trying to be a good Deputy Secretary of Defense for policy, but geez, old Petraeus just didn't quite pull it off, did he? But if you're David Petraeus, who do you have to blame? Oh, Obama. Except Obama gave him everything he wanted. Get the hell out of here, man. And McMaster worked for him when they lost the war. So for them to come out now complaining and for every media source that hosts them on TV to just let them go on and never contradict them and never say, but yeah, but if you had won the war 10 years ago, this wouldn't really be an issue, would it? No one even has the courage to even say that. The most obvious thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially for Petraeus, who they, you know, portrayed as though he had won World War II, when all he had done was finish winning a civil war for the majority, the super majority in Iraq, who then told him to get the hell out. What the hell kind of victory is that? David Petraeus is a multiple-time loser. Who made me start counting the ways? But he's never achieved anything in his life other than producing that movie Argo, which actually sucked. So, you know, for them to be on TV now saying, oh no, geez, we got to stay. You know, I'd like to see David Petraeus, see if he could just raise an army of volunteers to go over there and fight with him to go and make the difference on their own dime and with their own voluntary support and see how many he can get.
I don't think that's going to be happening. I'm really glad you brought up Max Boot because my listeners know how much I hate that scumbag. So anytime
he's the worst. He's the guy that wrote The Case for American Empire in the Weekly Standard, or was it the National Review? I think it was in the Weekly Standard in, would have been early 2002, I'm pretty sure. And he's been wrong about every single thing the entire time. In fact, when I think back on the Afghan surge and the whole debate over the counterinsurgency doctrine and all of that crap, one of the things that comes to mind is a debate on MSNBC between Jeremy Scahill, the leftist reporter formerly from Democracy Now! And now at The Intercept, the guy who published the drone papers.
Right.
And it's Scahill versus Max Boot. And Scahill's like, look, man, I went to the Helmand province. I interviewed the Taliban. And this is what they told me. You can't beat us. We got all the time in the world. Or whatever the quotes were.
Right.
We're like, Scahill just absolutely had it. And Max Boot can only sputter and insist that, nuh-uh, you don't know what you're talking about. Dave Petraeus is the greatest general ever, and he knows what to do. And the coin doctrine is going to be great and all of this kind of thing. And it, you know, it didn't matter that, you know, he had no leg to stand on. He couldn't form a coherent argument, certainly not against Scahill, who had been to Helmand and back, which, yep. Hell, I wouldn't go there. You know, he went and met with these guys on their home territory. Pardon me. Went and met with them on their home territory and reported back that this ain't going to work. You know, this would have been like spring of 09, right before they launched the surge. And then he, you know, whoops, Max Boot, up and down the playground, and then Boot wins anyway. And we do it all anyway.
Yeah.
You know? It ain't fair, but that's just how it goes. You
it's
know?
Crazy. We'll wrap up with this last question. I'm curious. I've been hearing lately they're talking about, coming out of China, that, hey, Taiwan, you should be watching what's going on in Afghanistan. That's how America will do you. They'll cut and run first chance that they get if things get a bit too much for them. Do you think there's any truth to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I hope so. We have no treaty obligation to Taiwan. We never had. I saw, you know, a friend of mine was interviewed the other day and somebody said, you know, if China attacks Taiwan, you think Biden will live up to our obligation to Taiwan? We have no obligation to Taiwan. We haven't, you know, our government hasn't pretended that Taiwan had its own sovereign, independent, legitimate government since 1972, when Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger went over there and shook hands with Mao Zedong and said that and began the process of officially recognizing the communist regime in Beijing as the official government, not just of the mainland, but also of Taiwan. And then what they did was they left what's called strategic ambiguity, where they said, we recognize a one China as a sovereign state here, including Taiwan, but we oppose the resolution of the conflict with force. But they never said what they would do about it. And they never signed a deal with Taiwan that said that we will come to your aid if you're ever attacked or anything like that. And then Jimmy Carter finished recognizing Beijing as the government of China. And it was in 1979, which is a full 30 years after they won the Civil War and took over the country. So yeah, kind of facing up to the unface-up-to-able. But then by then, Mao was dead and the right wing of the Communist Party won. And Deng Xiaoping wanted to get along with the West and open up trade and capitalism and all that, which is what they did. So, you know, by that point, what the hell? But anyway, so then when it comes to Taiwan, we sold them plenty of weapons so that at least they'll have some kind of a fighting chance if it comes down to it. But the reality is that they're simply overmatched. And if it comes down to a real war, China's going to win it. And if you look closely, you'll see that when the Navy does red-blue war games on this, the Chinese win. The American fleet goes to the bottom of the ocean and the Chinese take Taiwan anyway. And so it's a war that the smarter among the admirals know that they don't want to fight, that they can't really win that war. China has the proximity and the advantage that comes with that. And they have supersonic sea skimming missiles that have a longer range than our F-18s. So what you going to do now? There goes your aircraft carriers. Can't even enter the combat theater without sinking to the bottom. And, you know, on and on like that. They've got us essentially, look, this is what the Americans and all the propaganda that you're hearing call, you know, the rise of Chinese aggression and imperialism and all that. If you read closely, they admit our military calls, their military strategy is A2AD, which means anti-access area denial, meaning they're building up the capacity to keep us out. That's it. They're not trying to take over the world. They're not trying to build a navy that can challenge America on the seven seas and all this stuff. They just want to be able to dominate their own region without American interference. And that's just not my problem.
Yeah.
And for America to fight a war with China over the independence of Taiwan, that is of not of America's national interest whatsoever. Like what, we get our computer chips made there, something like that? Right. We're supposed to fight a war, lose an aircraft carrier with 10,000 sailors aboard, maybe get into a nuclear exchange where we lose, you know, Honolulu or Los Angeles, and then still lose Taipei anyway. It makes no sense whatsoever. So yeah, the Taiwanese ought to look closely at what's going on in Afghanistan. At the end of the day, Afghanistan is not the American people's problem, no matter how bad our government tries to make it our problem. And at the end of the day, we'll turn around and leave, no matter what Condoleezza Rice said about how she swears to God we never will. Yeah, we will. And, you know, the Taiwanese have to accept that they're in a bad situation. It's the same situation you and I are in. We don't want to be governed by the government that we're governed by.
Right.
But we kind of still live here anyway, because what the hell are you going to do? Right. I mean, they are in possession of this pretty big island off the coast of this already massive empire with a GDP that far outmatches theirs and a military capacity to win a war under, you know, it would, there are, you know, different ideas about exactly how difficult or easy it would be for China to win it. But at the same time, too, I just flip a coin and bet, if I had to bet, that if there is a real war over Taiwan, it'll be a crisis that the Americans help precipitate by encouraging the most, you know, radical and secessionist forces among the Taiwanese to encouraging them to cause a fight and get in trouble. And in fact, one more thing real quick and I got to go, but Gareth Porter wrote a piece about, we had what was called the dual deterrent strategy, which was, hey, China, you really shouldn't threaten Taiwan, man. We really don't like that. And you don't know exactly what we'd do, but it'd be something. while at the same time telling the Taiwanese, you guys pipe down. We don't necessarily have your back. And so you will not be so damn loud with all your radical secessionist talk. But now they've abandoned that strategy. Now it's more tough talk toward China and no longer telling the Taiwanese to pipe down. And now, I don't know the name of the lady. I'm way behind on this, but read Gareth Porter's great piece on it. The lady that's in charge in Taiwan now, her term is almost up. And the guy in line behind her from her same party is from a much more radical faction of her same party. And, you know, promises, well, not promises, but, you know, threatens to be the cause of new conflict coming soon here. So, yeah, look, America should not be passing out war guarantees to anybody. The Soviet Union is gone, 30 years gone. And you know what? What's happening now? China's not taking over the world. It's just the rise of the multipolar world. And America must retrench. We had the unipolar world for 30 years. Not really, but almost. But now it's just not like that anymore. Other countries make enough, you know, have a high enough GDP and have enough influence in the world that we've got to respect their opinion. And that includes China and Russia and India and Brazil and other of these kind of middle rank powers, where everybody's not just going to bow down and do what America says. That doesn't mean they're threatening us. That doesn't mean they're going to take over the world. Does anybody really believe China's going to roll into Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan and Uzbekistan and rule over all of Central Asia? They're going to roll into, you know, Mongolia and Vietnam. Nobody even thinks that. It's all just pretend. Oh, but we're supposed to think they're coming here. Come on. You know, this is all because America is a falling, flailing empire, lashing out and blaming everybody but its own leaders for their own stupid errors and self-inflicted wounds. Not all of them errors, but yeah. And I'm sorry I'm late and my guy's going to kill me, but I got to go. But thank you so much.
That's Scott Horton, everybody. You can catch his work at antiwar.com. Links to his books will be in the description. Thanks, Scott. You're the best. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you.